Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krilwich.
This is Radio Lab, and today we're talking about color.
Okay.
And that actually brings us back to Jay Knights.
I'm a professor of ophthalmology, University of Washington, Seattle.
Jay has actually spent his entire career trying to get creatures to see colors that they normally can't see. And he started, this is kind of an interesting story, by taking some colorblind monkeys who couldn't see red.
They have blue cones, green cones, but no red cones.
Which is not unlike a lot of human males. In any case, he had these monkeys and was able to take the human gene for the red cone, wrap it in a virus, inject it into the monkey's eyes, and bam! The monkeys suddenly had red cones.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So it had blue, green, and red.
Was this like LASIK? So it was just like a 10-minute outpatient situation for the monkeys?
I would say close. Close to LASIK.
Could they then now see red?
Well, every single morning before they get their breakfast, they have to do their color vision test. So
we'd sit each monkey at a computer.
We had a touch screen.
And the screen looks totally gray. But in that field of gray, he adds a little red blob.
Right.
Now here's the key.
We use grape juice as the reinforcement.
For the monkeys.
But
the game is,
you have to touch the blob before you get your juice.
So before the surgery, they weren't seeing any blobs, and they weren't getting any juice. Because all they could see was gray. So a little red blob could be right there in front of them, and they'd never see it. And the morning after their LASIK color booster shot.
Okay, touch it if you see it.
They still couldn't see it. Day after day, they would do their test.
Mm-hmm.
And every day they would fail.
Every day they would fail.
No blob. No juice.
But it's fun for them. They get out of their cage and they talk to their friends and...
Did you fail? Yeah, I failed. You fail. I failed.
Another day, another fail.
Until one morning, after about
20 weeks,
Jay woke up the monkeys, gave them the test.
And they began to not fail.
Really? If you watch the video of this, it actually looks like the monkey is like, wow.
You know, I'm not having any failures.
And check out this dot. Look at this thing.
Check it out.
So I did get some sense that they felt like that their life had improved.
Now, if this works so well with the monkeys, couldn't you take a colorblind human and give them back the thing they're missing?
Absolutely. We could cure colorblindness in a human with exactly this technique.
Really?
The only thing that we have to do is convince the FDA that the risks are low enough and the benefit is high enough that it'd be something we could do in people.
Have you never tried it? Or?
No, we've never tried it. Although I get a lot of emails that say, I don't care what the risks are. I've even had offers. How about if I come to your laboratory and you don't tell anybody late at night and you give me the shot in the eye and we won't tell anyone?
Which brings us back to our original question. If you can take a colorblind human and give them normal color vision, could you take a normal color seer and boost them to make them a little more shrimpy?
Well, yes, yeah.
You said, sure, why not? But then there's the whole FDA thing. But here's the real surprise.
Jay says there are some people who are already a little bit mantis shrimp-like. There are color mutants, if I may call them that, in the nicest possible way, among us.
Or they're out there in theory. Okay, so here's the deal. The genes for the cones in our eyes that see color, you know, the red, green, blue cones?
Yep.
They're on the X chromosome. Now, men, as we know, only have one of those.
Women have two X chromosomes.
Which means that women have two sets of these cone-making genes. Normally, one set is just a spare. It's not used, but still they've got two sets.
And so someone said, aha.
It is theoretically possible that in some women, this spare set of genes might mix up, turn on, morph into a whole new cone, a fourth cone.
We're going to call it the yellow cone.
So if people with normal color vision are trichromats, because we've got three cones.
A woman like that would be a tetrachromat. So altogether, she'd have a blue cone, a green cone, a yellow cone, and a red cone.
But she wouldn't just see more yellow. This new yellow would mix with the red and the blue and the green to create thousands, maybe millions of more shades of color.
This amazing... The technicolor is not the right word. It's whatever would be the next kind of color that would be even more super duper.
This was just a thought experiment?
Yeah, but...
Jay actually figured out a way to test for this.
We can look in people's blood, and I can say this woman has the genes for blue cones, green cones, yellow cones, red cones.
Oh, so you can do a DNA test, really.
Yeah.
So he started doing blood tests, and he found this one woman.
She worked at the same place we did.
Crazily enough.
At the university.
He looked at her DNA, and he saw the gene for the fourth cone.
Yeah.
So did she see in super technicolor, or how would you even know?
That was a problem. And so we thought of an experiment in order to be able to see whether or not she had this extra dimension of color vision.
He was able to produce these two yellow lights that to us, you know, trichromats, normal trichromats, look totally identical.
We're colorblind to that difference.
But to a tetrachromat, a woman with this fourth cone, they would look totally different.
Yeah. So they brought her in. I said, okay, here it is. Do you see these as different? And she said, no.
No.
I don't see them as any different.
No.
But the story doesn't end there.
Good.
Jay told us about a colleague of his in England.
She's at Newcastle.
Named Gabrielle Jordan. And she apparently found eight of these women with lots the extra cone. And out of those eight?
Seven of those women behaved exactly like the person that I had tested.
Couldn't see the difference.
But one of them
took one look at those two yellows and said,
no, they look totally different to me.
Ho-ho. One of these women saw it as different. So one of them had the cone, but could use it, and the others had the cone, but couldn't use it?
Yep. So why is that?
Yeah, why?
Well, this is the part, if you'd like, I could tell you what my theory is of what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think that...
Jay says, let's just imagine you grow up in a world without color.
Completely and totally a black and white world. Houses would be painted black and white. Printers would only print in black and white.
Even the TVs.
They would just have black and white TV. Women's makeup would be just, you know, either dark or light.
So it wouldn't make any difference if you had color vision because you would never use that color vision. There'd be no words for color. Now, just to make it interesting, let's imagine one day a bright red apple plops into your world.
How would you react to it?
Would you see it, you think?
Well, so that's a very good question.
Maybe, says Jay, even though you have the ability to see that red apple, if you've never had a chance to use that ability to practice, it may just lay dormant. And that, he thinks, might be what happens to women living with the extra cone in our world.
They're very rarely subjected to colors that would stimulate their extra kind of cone differently.
So you're saying those other colors just aren't around enough for them?
Yeah. Everything that we make is based on the fact that humans are trichromatic. The television only has three colors. Our color printers have three different colors. There's nothing out there that we make artificially that a tetrachromat could see.
But Jay says maybe.
Some women, because they're just more aware or because of the job that they do.
Maybe someone who works with color all the time, like a florist or a painter.
Little by little.
Because they're paying such close attention.
Their brain would learn to see that difference.
So naturally, we wanted to find one of these mythic
Well,
ladies.
I hope they're not mythic, maybe. Yeah.
The reason I say that is because we tried to find that one woman that he mentioned, you know, the one out of eight.
Yeah.
And we had a really hard time, and we began to doubt that she even existed. And then we began to look online, and you see all these websites saying, are you a tetrachromat? Contact us, contact us. Everybody is searching for these women, and we began to feel like we were chasing unicorns a little bit. Right. But then our producer, Tim Howard, claimed that he had found one.
Recalculating. Yeah, you are.
Turn right on Sarah Street.
He'd been in touch with Jay. Jay told him that he'd tested a woman, determined that she had the fourth cone, and this woman was an interior designer.
Oh.
But Jay had not yet determined whether she could use her fourth cone, so we sent Tim to Pittsburgh, where she lives, to see what he could find out.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, I'm Susan Hogan. I'm a mother of three and an interior designer.
What was she like?
She's great.
Oh, you have a jukebox.
Uh-huh. Really? You want me to play something?
How about number 307? It just seems appropriate because it's about color.
White or shade of pale.
She told me a lot about how she uses color in her work.
You see the different colors of paint.
Because she thinks a lot about it in terms of painting walls.
I know the way the sun is oriented in a room. Each wall will look a different color, even though you paint.
In any case, here was my plan. I'd ordered this test before I went to Pittsburgh that Jay had suggested I get.
All right, open it.
It involved these little pieces of brown fabric.
Okay.
They all look identical.
They look strikingly the same to me.
Yeah, Lynn, Brenna, me, Soren.
Those are completely indistinguishable. Yeah.
Couldn't see a difference.
Do they all look the same to you guys?
Yes.
But I'm assuming they're actually not all the same.
That's the trick. Jay said, if you show them to a real tetrachromat, they're going to be able to see these subtle differences that, you know, you and I can't see. And back to Pittsburgh.
So how about we head over toward that tree? Is that look
good? I need to take my shoes off.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be much more fun for me.
We ended up doing the test in a nearby park.
We're going to do a bunch of these, if you don't mind.
In the first trial, I took out three of the swatches. Two that were exactly the same, and one that was supposedly different.
And when you took it out, could you see the difference?
No. Huh. So I go behind the tree, and I whisper into the mic, number three is different. Number three. I hope you couldn't hear me.
No.
I'll let you take a look. She steps back from the swatches, gives it a look for a moment, and then she says,
number three. Said,
third one is different.
Looks more neutral, less red than one and two on the left.
One for one.
Luck.
So I went behind the tree.
All right, 1 second.
Changed up the swatches. So that now, the middle swatch was the odd one out.
And same deal, ready, set, go.
Easy.
Which number looks different?
The middle one.
Number two?
Mm-hmm.
You are right.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Then I figured I gotta make it harder. I switched it up, and I made it so all three are different, and I didn't tell her.
All three are different.
All three different.
Wow.
I have green, red, less red. As I went.
Knocking it out of the park.
Why didn't I do this well on my SATs, Tim?
Wow, you found her. I was sure that she was not going to be. There's no way this test can work.
Well, it actually might not have totally worked.
Wait, what? Did she start to fail?
There's one little thing I didn't mention.
How you doing?
What?
I brought along a friend.
I'm Jason LaCroix.
Painter.
Landscape, still life.
Thought I'd try him out as a control.
Oh, because you were thinking, let's get someone who likes color but is a boy and can't be a tetrachromat.
Right.
Okay, so.
And when we tried the exact same test with him.
I mean, these three, they look the same, don't they, to you? No?
I see different.
He was amazing.
Uh-oh.
Every time.
The first one on the left. Two jumped out immediately. Mm-hmm. Number one. They all three look different to me.
Wow.
Was he just as good as Susan?
Yeah. I was a little bit disappointed, I gotta say.
And there was nowhere where he couldn't do it and she could?
No, but I mean, I only had pieces of brown cloth, you know?
So it doesn't prove anything, I guess. She still might be a tetrachromat, right?
For all I know. And there was this one moment. I know it doesn't prove anything, but I asked her about the sky. And the sky was just that quintessential sky blue. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what do you see? And she's like,
I see, do you see some of the pink in the blue? See, I see a lot of pink, like, among the blue. There's red in that blue section.
She was looking up at a blue sky and seeing red?
Yeah.
Do you see that?
No.
Oh, I see so much red, like, up it. And it's...
It's kind of a cop-out, but it's just kind of that perfect sky blue.
Okay, that's... That's
where do you
a good.
See the reds?
It's just mixed in there.
That's cool.
One thing I don't see is any green in that blue. I just see reds, right, especially around the white clouded section.
And at that moment, I felt like my sky is boring.
I'm so sorry for you. For us.
I'm sorry for us.
How do I know? I mean, how do we know that any of this makes sense? You know, that's the fun of it, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was later, as a miller told his tale, that a face at first just ghostly turned to whiter. shade of pale.
You know what we haven't talked about yet?
What's that?
Where do the colors come from?
You mean like sky colors?
No, like painterly colors, like marine blue and
oh, like artificial colors.
Well, no, they're not artificial. That's the thing. You'd think they come from a factory or something, but originally they came from the earth.
Yeah.
And there's one story about color that has haunted me. For about a year and a half. It's so strange.
Mm.
I don't know if it's true or not, but I mean, I don't know if you...
It was in my book, of course it's true.
That's Victoria Finley again. Her book is called Color. And this story starts with, well, a particular kind of goop.
It's a color called gamboge. It's named after Cambodia, the French word for Cambodia. And it comes from the sap of a tree that grows in the Cambodia-Vietnam-Thailand border area.
And this is a yellow color?
Well, it's a yellow color, but...
How you get it is really the sticky part.
I mean, the way they get it is that they cut a slash in the bark and then hitch up a tube made of bamboo.
About the circumference of a quarter?
Yes.
And then little droplets of goop come out?
Little tiny droplets of goop.
And they fill up the tube. The same way you get maple syrup or rubber.
But they leave it for a couple of years.
Years.
Years. All right, so it's a really slow process.
So slow.
Drop.
That some pretty strange things.
Drop.
Can happen in that time.
What do you mean?
Sap has secrets.
Secrets? What secrets?
Wait a minute. So, after 2 long years, the harvesters come back, and each of those tubes...
is now full of this, quite like plastic. It's got that sort of plastic resiny kind of feel.
But that's just the beginning. The resin makes this incredible transformation, which we actually saw, Sean and I.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks to this guy.
My name is George Kramer. I'm a colorman.
He owns Kramer's Pigments in Manhattan, and he sells this gamboge.
It is an important yellow.
Oh, it's amazing when you use it.
We have a powdered and the resin form.
So when you have a look at it,
okay, this here,
it's just like this dull, ochre brown color.
You can imagine like a ball of earwax.
And you think, oh, that's not a very interesting color.
The dusky sort of...
That's like a really boring color. But then you put a drop of water on it.
Or you grind it up in a bowl with a little water.
When you grind it, it looks like this.
Ooh.
You see?
And there it is.
Wow. There's a little bit of white.
It's bright.
Very bright yellow.
It's bright, fluorescent yellow.
Suddenly it's like pow.
I mean, it is quite an exciting color.
Very, very yellow.
Wow. I carried one around for ages. So I'd say, have a look at this color. Look how boring it is. Now put a drop of water on it. Showing kids, and I was really happy. I even gave it to one kid who was just so delighted. And it was only afterwards that I found out that it's so dangerous. I mean,
Wait, it's dangerous? Why?
Why?
You get a bad diarrhea.
When the guys used to chip it in small pieces, there was actually a time built in for them to visit the toilet at least once an hour.
Ian Garrett knows that because he was technical director at this art supply company called Windsor & Newton in England. And here's what really got us interested in all this. Back in the 1980s, Windsor & Newton would get these shipments of gamboge from Cambodia, and they would take it to this production room.
It's quite a dusty area. Just had a table in there.
Big old table where the workers would sit.
And then they would have this hammer, put the gamboge pieces on this lump of iron, and then hit it and shatter it into small pieces.
Because that's how they make it into a kind of usable, sellable paint.
And one day, as one of the workers was chipping and scraping at the resin...
There they were.
They found something in the resin that they didn't expect.
They found bullets.
Bullets? Like in the hunks of resin?
Lodged in them, yep.
Sometime in that 2-year drip, drip process. Toward the end, probably, as the resin was getting thick, a bullet went whizzing through the air, went thwack into the goop, and stayed there. Actually, it wasn't just one bullet.
There's a total of about a dozen.
And those are just the ones he found lying around the factory. There were probably many more.
They fall into two sorts. There's a very sharp, pointed one, about just over an inch long. And then the other type are small sort of barrel shapes, which are about 3/4 of an inch long, about half a dozen of each. And how they got there and what they passed through on the way into the Gamboge, I'm not sure.
But what we do know, of course, is that those years in Cambodia were years of war and murder. 1.5 million people died there, most of them in the killing fields. And that's the same place where you'd find the Gamboge trees.
I mean, it's shocking, really, and because those were just the random little bamboo tubes hanging on the trees. What happened in that grove? What terrible things happened?
The proposition here would be that at some point, maybe because of the famous killing fields, mm-hmm. that some 14-year-olds with Kalashnikov rifles, after finishing a series of murders or just shot lots of bullets...
They would have just sprayed that grove in order to get into the little tiny bamboo canisters collecting this gamboge. Yeah, wow. They would have had to have sprayed that entire grove with machine gun bullets. And in that year or 2 years, somebody murdered... people, I should think.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily a battle scenario. It could have been target practice. You see these things hanging on the side of a tree. You want to practice your marksmanship.
But, there is a way in which there's violence in this color. I guess there's violence. It makes me wonder about Does it ever give you pause?
Does it ever give me what? Sorry?
Pause?
Pause.
Yeah.
Not really. We were too remote. Bought it from a guy in Holland who bought it from an exporter who got it from Lord knows where in Cambodia.
But the idea that it could have been attached to that bloodshed, does that bother you at all?
Are you saying, do I think it's morally acceptable? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah.
It wasn't Winsor & Newton who discovered these things. These things were demanded by customers.
You're a hard-hearted man, I feel.
I had never thought about it until you pitched it like that.
As we kept on talking, Ian made it clear it wasn't that he hadn't thought about the violence, per se. It's just that it wasn't like breaking news to him. They sell some pigments that come straight out of hills that are right in the middle of war zones. Okay. Colors are sometimes soaked in blood. That's just how it is.
On the other side of the coin, I've made it my career in 40 years to make artists' paints on the basis that people who paint tend not to make war. It's a peaceful occupation.
That is more or less what they used in the
And
caves.
George Kramer, who runs the paint shop, he was pretty much of the same mind.
It is a hard...
You could think of it this way. Imagine the first person to ever find this brilliant yellow, maybe 10,000 years ago. He's walking through the forest after it's rained, and he sees it there on a tree, and he's amazed. So he puts his finger into the yellow and then dabs some on his face, and he feels instantly beautiful, like larger than himself.
It is about being related to something transcendent.
And that, says George, is the other side of the coin.
To an upper high or whatever. Therefore, they probably used it for all sorts of ceremonies.
Marriages, feasts, maybe war paint to feel invincible. Any moment he suspects that needed to be pulled out of the ordinary and lifted up.
And there you need something what is bright, something what is beautiful and special. And this yellow gives you something special. It is a perfect yellow.
Thank you.
Thank you to Victoria Finley. Her book is called Color, short and simple, to the point.
And to Ian Garrett of Winsor & Newton, who did not wither under our withering moral attack.
On the contrary.
This is Amy Lantinga from Boston, Massachusetts. Radiolab is supported, in part, by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.